Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Vicor Corp earnings results for the third quarter ending September 30th, 2013 call. My name is Denise, and I'll be your operator for today. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If at any time you require operator assistance, please press star zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded for replay purposes. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host for today, Mr. Jamie Sims, CFO of Vicor. Please proceed.
Thanks, Denise. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our conference call for the third quarter ended September 30th. I'm Jamie Sims, Chief Financial Officer, and with me here in Andover, Massachusetts, is Patrizio Vinciarelli, CEO. Today we issued a press release summarizing our financial results for the third quarter. This press release is available on the investor page of our website, vicorpower.com. We also have filed a Form 8K with the SEC in association with issuing this press release. Once again, I remind listeners this conference call is being recorded and is the copyrighted property of Vicor Corporation. I also remind you various remarks we make during this call may constitute forward-looking statements for purposes of the Safe Harbor provisions under the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act of 1995. Our forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties that may cause actual results to differ materially from those explicitly set forth or implied in our statements. Such risks and uncertainties are discussed in our most recent Forms 10-K and 10-Q filed with the SEC. Please note the information provided during this conference call is accurate only as of the date of the call. We undertake no obligation to update any of the statements made during this call, and you should not rely upon them after the conclusion of the call. A replay will be available beginning at midnight tonight through November 6th. The replay dial-in number is 888-286-8010, and the passcode is 178-357-49. In addition, a webcast replay of the call will be available on our IR page shortly upon the conclusion of the call. I will start this evening's call with a review of our financial performance for the third quarter, and Patrizio will follow with his comments, after which we will take your questions. As set forth in this afternoon's press release, Vicor reported an after-tax loss for the third quarter of $932,000, representing a net loss of 2 cents per share. This compares to the second quarter after-tax loss of $4.6 million, which represented a loss of 12 cents per share. For both the second and third quarter, we used a basic share count of 38,538,000 shares to calculate EPS. Vicor's consolidated revenue for the third quarter increased 17.6% sequentially to $55.1 million from the $46.9 million recorded for the second quarter of 2013. The third quarter figure compares to revenue of $53 million for the third quarter of 2012, representing a year-over-year quarterly increase of 4.1%. The BRIC business unit, our largest, recorded a 5.3% sequential increase in revenue, coincidentally the second consecutive quarterly increase of 5.3%, while VI Chip also repeated its prior quarter's performance, again nearly doubling revenue, up 98% sequentially. All of our businesses experienced improved revenue for the quarter, reflecting the rebound in bookings during the second quarter. The third quarter's revenue came in slightly ahead of our own forecast. Turns revenue, meaning orders booked and shipped within the quarter, declined again to approximately 38% of revenue for the third quarter, down from 41% for the second quarter and 47% for the first quarter, the highest level in recent memory. This decline largely reflects the increase in VI chip shipments of orders to be shipped across more than one quarter. Given that we build to order and our lead times to delivery range by product from 3 weeks to 12 weeks, a lower dependency on turns revenue implies greater visibility in our forecasts. Backlog totaled $53.9 million as of September 30th, of which 71% was scheduled for shipment during the current quarter. Recognized sell-through revenue for the third quarter associated with shipments by our stocking distributors increased over 44% to $2.1 million from the prior quarter's $1.5 million. As I state every quarter, please keep in mind for financial reporting purposes, we segregate customers by the address to which we ship. With the exception of Vicor Japan, all of our subsidiaries sell in dollars, and all of our products, again with the exception of those manufactured by Vicor Japan, are exported from the U.S. International revenue rose to 61% of total revenue for the third quarter, up from 58% for the second. The increase in VI chip shipments, which primarily go to Asian contract manufacturers working for our domestic OEM customers, was the primary contributor to the increased percentage of total consolidated revenue represented by international activities. BBU exports were flat sequentially, while VJCL dollar revenue recovered from the second quarter's low point. If VI chip shipments to contract manufacturers are not considered, shipments across the Asia-Pacific region, excluding Japan, were unchanged or declined slightly from country to country, reflecting softer second quarter booking patterns. Our largest market in the region, China, inclusive of Hong Kong and Shanghai operations, experienced a 9% decline in shipments for the quarter. As stated last quarter, our definition of Europe going forward for purposes of these conference calls includes Northern Europe, Southern Europe, and Eastern Europe, inclusive of Poland, Russia, and the Ukraine. We are segregating Turkey and Israel, which had been included in Southern Europe when we discussed the region. As a whole, European shipments declined 9% sequentially, despite continued double-digit expansion in Russia, which has quickly become a major market for us. Historically important markets for us, such as the UK, continue to be weak, reflecting poor conditions in defense electronics. After a brief disruption earlier in the year due to a transition in distribution partners, Israel recovered to customary levels and shows signs of sustained growth. Turning to new orders, third quarter bookings declined 6.7%. However, recall bookings increased 24 and 26% respectively for the prior two quarters. Second quarter bookings included orders associated with a VI chip design win in the data center space, as well as a significant defense electronics order for the BBU. If this single defense electronics order is not considered, all other booking activity actually increased approximately 5%, reflecting an increase in order flow for VI Chip's data center solution, continued growth in Russia, a recovery in bookings in key markets, notably China and Germany, and a 20% increase in orders from our stocking distributors. The data center volumes are scheduled to be shipped well into the first half of 2014 based on current backlog, and the defense electronics order begins meaningful shipments in the first quarter. As has been the case for some time, the BBU continues to experience varying demand for its modules and configurable products. We hope macroeconomic conditions firm at some point, but we anticipate real recovery for the BBU will be based on new solutions enabled by the chip modules Patricio will be discussing in a moment. Turning to the income statement, consolidated gross margin improved to 41.7% for the third quarter, up from 39.4% for the second. The improvement was largely the result of improved capacity utilization and overhead absorption, notably in VI chip, which recorded a record gross profit margin. Total operating expenses declined 4.4% on an as-reported basis. During the third quarter, we did not incur any notable or irregular operating expenses, in contrast to the prior quarter, during which we recorded $1.1 million of charges associated with the stock option exchange we completed in June, a training initiative, and an anomalous bad debt charge due to a customer bankruptcy filing. While commissions did increase this quarter, as expected with the rise in revenue, and we continue to expand our Asian footprint with an office in Seoul, South Korea established during the quarter, other operating expenses, including legal fees, were steady for the period. Total headcount stood at 993 as of September 30th, compared to 997 as of June 30th. A year ago, total headcount stood at 1,044. Until we achieve robust profitability, we will continue to closely scrutinize discretionary spending. However, we are not going to find our way to profitability through expense reduction. We have established a marketing and sales infrastructure capable of supporting significantly higher volumes of business, so there is a chicken and egg aspect to our cost structure. While we can be prudent in assessing incremental expense, achieving profitability through cost reductions or cutting back investment in our future would be the wrong trade-off. In addition, we continue to spend heavily on product development given the opportunities presented by our product roadmap. As such, the top line will drive profitability in the next year as we leverage our considerable long-term investment in our future. Turning to taxes for the third quarter, we recorded an income tax benefit of approximately $406,000 based on our forecast for a full-year taxable loss. I want to highlight the possibility, and I emphasize possibility, the company at some point in the coming quarters may need to increase the valuation allowance we apply to the deferred tax assets we carry. Increasing the valuation allowance would represent a non-cash charge to earnings and, given the circumstances, such a charge could be material. We have a net federal deferred tax asset balance of approximately $11.3 million as of September 30th. We also have a valuation allowance totaling approximately $11.5 million, the majority of which offsets state-level deferred tax assets, which have been fully reserved. Significant management judgment is required in determining whether deferred tax assets will be realized in full or in part. Every quarter, we assess the amount of the valuation allowance offsetting the value of these assets. For the third quarter, our conclusion was, based on our assessment of all available evidence, both positive and negative, the company met the more likely than not standard regarding the likelihood sufficient profit would be generated in the future to utilize the net federal deferred tax asset carried. Elements of this assessment include projected future taxable income, tax planning strategies, scheduled reversals of deferred tax liabilities, if any, and income in the carryback period. Recall that when we went through this quarterly exercise for the fourth quarter of 2012, we concluded we would be able to utilize the net value of the federal deferred tax asset carried, but we determined we would not be able to use the state deferred tax asset carried due to idiosyncrasies in the use of carrybacks and carryforwards at the state level. At the same time, we fully reserved against the value of these remaining state deferred tax assets, taking a non-cash charge of approximately $1.5 million. Going forward, due to our consecutive quarterly losses and uncertainty regarding our time frame to sustain profitability, we will closely evaluate the likelihood sufficient profit will be generated to fully utilize the net federal deferred assets, tax asset balance. If we determine the more likely than not standard will not be met, then the valuation allowance may need to be increased, and such an increase could result in a material non-cash charge. Having said this, I should also point out that the valuation allowance door swings both ways, in that sustained robust profitability could lead management to conclude some or all of the valuation allowance should be released, thereby creating a non-cash tax benefit, which could be material. Recall that during the third and fourth quarters of 2010, the company recorded non-cash tax benefits of $5.2 million, or 12 cents per share, and $1.2 million, or 3 cents per share, respectively, due to the release of portions of our valuation allowance against deferred tax assets. Turning to cash flow. Cash flow from operations for the third quarter recovered to a positive $1.5 million from the second quarter deficit of $2.5 million. Despite the increase in shipments and production, we did not experience a meaningful swing in working capital for the quarter. Capital expenditures for the quarter were steady at $1.5 million. We still anticipate beginning the build-out of our chip production capabilities during the fourth quarter, but also anticipate the actual dollar investment for the quarter will be lower than the originally forecast $5 million, with more design and purchase order activity than actual spending, which will be recorded in Q1 and Q2 of 2014. As earlier discussed, we expect our total investment for chip build-out to exceed $10 million. Turning to the consolidated balance sheet, our receivables portfolio remains in excellent shape, with day sales declining to 43 days from the prior quarter's 45 days. Consolidated inventories quarter to quarter declined for the fourth consecutive quarter, driving annual turnover to just over four for the first time in recent memory. There were no meaningful charges or changes to reserves. Cash at quarter end stood at $61.2 million, up from $60.8 million last quarter. We also hold certificates of deposit carried at their face value of $1.2 million and long-term investment securities with a par value of $6.0 million carried at an estimated fair value of $5.0 million, representing roughly 83% of par value. Turning to our expectations for the fourth quarter, we are forecasting relatively little sequential change. We do anticipate reducing our net loss slightly, but based on current backlog, booking patterns, and expense trends, we will break even at best. We expect a further increase in revenue and steady margins, but we also expect any improved product-level results will be offset by a step-up in resources and legal fees related to IP litigation. We also are expecting increased R&D and engineering expenses as we roll out our new chip and SIP product lines. This concludes my prepared remarks regarding our financials. Now I'll turn it over to Patricio.
Thank you, Jamie. As Jamie has described, the third quarter was characterized by performance improvement in VHIP, substantially doubling its manufacturing volume to a new record of production units. This is very encouraging, as we are confirming our VHIP operating assumptions, which will be applicable to our new chip products, the manufacturing of which leverages the lessons learned from first-generation VHIPs. As a reminder, CHIP is an acronym for Converter Housed in Package, what we refer to as funnel-molded packages during the development phase. The power density, high efficiency, and scalability of CHIP modules make them attractive to market leaders seeking to differentiate their own next-generation systems. We expect to be transitioning during the second quarter of 2014 to production of CHIPs that will expand upon the first generation via chips that provide the initial penetration of high-end servers and data center solutions. While our first generation solution consists of via chip PRMs and VTMs, our next generation solution consists of SIP PRMs and chip VTMs, providing greater efficiency and density at a considerably lower cost for the coming generations of Intel VR standards, beginning with VR12, which will be rolled out next year. While our 2014 production efforts will be focused on expanding chip capacity, we will continue to produce first-generation VR chips as their use in certain applications continues. While we do not have visibility into demand within the supercomputing segment, as federal funding remains quite uncertain, we have other applications for first-generation VR chips. Disappointment associated with the state of the supercomputing business is more than offset by enthusiasm for the reception chip modules and SIP regulators have received across a range of applications. Design inactivity is accelerating with an expanding list of well-known large-scale enterprise computing manufacturers, test and measurement vendors, communication OEMs, and defense electronic contractors. Chips and SIPs are being designed to platforms that should ramp in the second half of 2014. Our chip platform is expected to dramatically cut the manufacturing cost per watt of our modules, well below the cost of first-generation VR chips. Our vision of a broad market for factorized power is predicated on breakthrough performance at a competitive cost, providing a compelling value proposition, especially for the high-volume OEM customers, which are critical to our growth strategy. First-generation VR chips were highly differentiated, but their manufacturing cost limited their acceptance to specialty applications, where performance trumped costs. Our vision is to enable a scalable, modular power system methodology using chips delivering high performance at very compelling cents per watt levels. Our near-term strategy is to establish Vicor and our chip and SIP-based solutions with high-profile customers while also driving broader market penetration. A subsequent penetration phase will leverage a chip-inside strategy across the fragmented market segments that have traditionally been served by the BBU and its units. We have developed a detailed plan already being executed upon to expand the VR chip manufacturing line to accommodate chip production. As Jamie mentioned, we earlier thought we'd be spending upwards of $5 million this quarter on new equipment, but we've been able to expand near-term capacity through productivity improvements, thus providing additional time for critical investments in capital equipment. We still anticipate a subsequent phase of expansion in 2014, requiring an additional investment of at least another $5 million. Despite the enthusiasm we have for promising new opportunities, many challenges remain. As Jamie addressed, we expect results to improve this quarter, but likely fall just short of profitability. We've been pleased with the efforts to control working capital growth, particularly with increased shipments, and are pleased to have been generating cash. While we may consume cash for capital expenditures, we have sufficient liquidity to fund the near-term needs. At the risk of repeating myself quarter to quarter, I'm confident Vicor is on the right path to long-term success. As we have the vision, technology, and product roadmap to serve the needs of a power system marketplace seeking higher performance, modular, scalable, and cost-effective solutions. We have redefined our go-to-market infrastructure, expanded our worldwide capabilities, and have partnered with well-positioned distributors. While we continue to face economic uncertainty, I see us delivering on the proper commitments that will enable and define our future. This concludes our prepared remarks, and we'll now take questions from listeners. Operator.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star 1. If your question has been answered or you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 2. To go ahead and get started with your question at this time, please press star 1. Again, if you do have a question at this time, please press star 1. Our first question comes from John Dillon. Please proceed.
Hey, Patricio. Congratulations on a really good quarter. In particular, it looks like your bookings and revenues are up pretty significantly. I do have a question on the next quarter. It sounded like you're going to have a break-even or a slight loss. How about the bookings and revenue? Do you expect those to continue to go up?
Yeah, we see a couple of quarters of modest growth in the top line and corresponding levels of bookings. We see a little bit of a lull period prior to a significant step up starting likely in the second quarter. But this outlook is, fluid, dependent, as I mentioned earlier, on a great deal of designing activity that could surprise us potentially in terms of earlier activity and potentially on the flip side in terms of delays.
And have you recalled a lot of the people that were furloughed a while back? For the increased shipments?
I'm sorry, but you're coming through with difficulty. And would you mind repeating the question? We could neither Jamie or I could understand.
Sure. Are you bringing back some of the people that were furloughed, the manufacturing people?
Well, we have been running some additional shifts. But our focus has been primarily to increase productivity, as I mentioned earlier, and we've been able to make strides in that general area. So obviously the level of activity in the factory has increased substantially, as you can expect, with VHIP shipments doubling quarter to quarter for a couple of quarters. So we're obviously a lot busier than we were only a few quarters ago when some downsizing was realized, particularly in VHIP operations, just before a major step up in activity leading within the last quarter to a record number of units. So we are still, as explained in the past, with particularly VHIP and even more so chip products, in a phase, in an early phase, where the business is not as statistical as we'd like it to be. We don't have yet the broader customer base that we've historically enjoyed with our brick products. It is only when we get to the level of increased penetration that will cause the revenues to be made up, and I'm referring to, you know, via chip revenues and PICO revenues, to be made up by a substantial number of customers and substantial level of diversification, that our operational needs and capacity needs will become more predictable. But I'm delighted with the way in which our operations and you know, all the people contributing to the success of the VHIP enterprise in terms of you know, managing capacity from a tier perspective and in terms of unit rates, have been able to respond to you know, the sudden increase in demand.
Okay, that sounds really good. So you're running were you running one shift initially, and you swifted changed to two shifts, or are you running three shifts now? How many shifts are you running?
We are not running, generally speaking, three shifts, but the level of activity has increased considerably. We still have capacity, capability beyond requirements over the next couple of quarters. And as I mentioned earlier in the prepared remarks, through the productivity improvements, we've been able to take a little bit more time to make purchases of additional equipment, which we're getting close to make, particularly in support of chip production rates.
Okay. Great. Congratulations on that. On the last conference call, I think you mentioned there was an AC to DC opportunity with the PFM. Is that still a viable opportunity? Has that progressed? And are you seeing any revenue from the PFM now?
So we made significant strides, both in terms of a broad customer base in small, you know, to medium volumes, and more recently with, in particular, a significant opportunity in Asia for our PFM product. And that's been based on an early generation PFM that, as you might have heard me say before, is about to be significantly improved through, you know, a new generation of devices that raise the power, the efficiency, the density, and most significantly reduce the cents per watt, the cost metrics considerably. So I'm happy that the key attributes of density, low profile, efficiency of the first generation PFM are giving us traction, not just with less cost-sensitive customers, but to some degree with more cost-sensitive customers. I'm looking forward to a near time frame in which the introduction of more advanced PFMs that are based on our chip platform will, you know, change our metrics in terms of cents per watt and the density in the right direction, opening up the PFM market opportunity considerably.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds from the outside that it looks like the PFM market is humongous. I mean, everything's AC to DC. I mean, there's just such a wide variety of products out there with a cost-reduced version. Do you have any kind of forecast on what you may be able to do in that product line alone in the coming years that you'd share with us?
Yeah, well, we do have evolving forecasts, and what I can say is that developments in the general area are becoming more and more exciting. Again, because of early traction with a first-generation PFM, which frankly is based on first-generation via chip technology, a relatively expensive proposition. We're going to be able to change key metrics of performance and cost to a level where, in one way of looking at it, a key parameter of goodness will be doubling. And then we are now developing the first chip PFMs are approaching prior introduction. We're now developing a further generation of AC-DC capabilities that will further raise the bar with respect to performance, efficiency, and most importantly, cents per watt cost reduction. That will get us into very much of the mainstream of AC-DC applications from a cost perspective.
But John, to answer your question, yes, we have a forecast, but no, we're not going to share it with you.
Right.
Well, thank you again, and I'll get back in the queue, but congratulations. It looks like things are really poised to take off here soon. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Don McKenna. Please proceed.
Hi, guys. I was, and excuse me, I've got a little bit of laryngitis here, but I was.
You're coming through loud and clear.
Okay, great. On the Intel VR12, how many approved vendors are there, and if you know, and or what percentage of the demand that they're going to have do you expect to be asked to fulfill?
So I think a little bit of a technical but not so technical explanation is in order to give you a better sense of the market opportunity. The lion's share of VR12, and it's to be expected the lion's share of VR12 and a half applications are going to continue to be powered from a 12-volt bus. That's not the area in which we play. Our opportunity has to do with the factorized power system, where we first got significant traction in high-end server application, which had to do with different kinds of processors, not Intel processor. And, within the last couple of years, has expanded now to Intel sockets that have moved from 12-volt to 48-volt power distribution because of a number of performance advantages that result in fundamentally lower TCO, or total cost of ownership, by data centers users. This is a trend that is accelerating. We are heavily engaged with major players that in effect make and use their own data center infrastructure, which are seeing the benefits of a 48-volt backbone and a factorized power solution, where in effect we're enabling a significant reduction in footprint in the motherboard, the elimination of bulk capacitors at the point of load, a significant improvement in point of load efficiency and total system efficiency, and all of these results in significant savings for companies that get to pay the electricity bills year after year. So that's a value proposition that is gaining traction. We've been able to establish it with first generation VR chips, which are suggested over and over again, are relatively expensive devices. We're going to be essentially cutting the cost in half in terms of cents per watt with chip-based solutions and PiCore-based SIP-type solutions. And as you can imagine, that will greatly expand the market opportunity for these devices. In a universe of Intel applications, again, that is still going to be largely dominated by 12-volt systems where we don't play. But the good news for us is that there is a great growth opportunity in the 48-volt portion of this market, which is rapidly growing because of significant performance and cost benefits.
Yeah, I had recently read that 10% of the U.S. consumption of electricity is in those data centers.
I actually think it's greater than that.
Yeah, and you know, obviously there's a lot of talk about taking our own responsibility with respect to, you know, a greener world, but as significantly the greenback element in terms of actual operating costs and cost savings is a driving factor. As you can imagine, you know, the profitability model of large data center users is dependent on being able to achieve lower operating costs.
Sure. And could you speak a minute to the increased litigation expenses you anticipate next quarter?
We anticipate a significant step up in litigation expenses. We recently retained an additional team of six lawyers working on the case, and you know, are making the investments necessary to ensure we're going to prevail.
Is this to defend yourself on suits that have been issued against you, or is it to still go after some of the patents that you always questioned?
Well, this is to defend ourselves against a suit that has been brought against us with fundamentally baseless allegations of infringement and questionable allegations of validity. So we believe that the patents that have been asserted against us are neither valid nor, in particular, infringed by our technology, which is, you know, fundamentally different, fundamentally superior. Unlike the earlier case in which the plaintiff was, you know, able to successfully assert claims against a large contingent of Asian companies with tradition of copying American technology. In our case, the products at a glance are fundamentally different, fundamentally superior, and we believe they do not come close to infringing any valid claim of patents that this company holds. But, you know, the reality of the situation is that the plaintiff was able, in a first round of litigation against Asian knockoff companies, for lack of better words, to establish a momentum in the Texas District Court, which they were then able to carry through to the Federal Circuit, and more recently they were able to carry through from the Federal Circuit to the Patent Board in successfully getting a reexamination by one of the artisan defendants, the defendant in the early litigation, where they were able to, you know, reverse the findings of the examiner with agreed one of four different examiners who had agreed that the patents were invalid and without merit. So this has been what you might call a domino effect in that the plaintiff has cleverly corralled a group of helpless copycat companies, and they've been able to leverage their action through successive wins at different levels. We are intending to stop that progression, and I think we have the merit on our side and the resources to ensure that it happens.
Historically, you've drawn the line in the sand a few times, with some success, with some failures, but you really feel confident on this one?
Well, I think we've had a great deal of experience litigating IP as a plaintiff against defendants, and we generally speaking won on asserting claims against defendants on meritorious patents. This is a case of patents that really are without merit. And in any case, even if they were valid, are not infringed by our products, which again are fundamentally different, fundamentally superior. I think a layperson can readily ascertain that. So I think it is a very fundamentally different situation from the one faced by the artisan defendants, and we are equipping ourselves to deal with it.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have a question, please press star 1. Our next question comes from Elaine Hicks. Please proceed.
Yeah, good afternoon. I had a question about PICOR and how that's how that business is doing, and also how does that complement the rest of your business?
So I would say PICOR is doing very well. I think execution there has been stellar. There is a very comprehensive way of new products. I think they played an instrumental role with respect to our data center, first data center customer win. They're playing an instrumental role with additional data center applications migrating to 48 volts. Their role is to provide a more silicon-centric part of our factorized power system solution, where they successfully integrated the regulator to a device that is smaller, more efficient, and a lot more cost-effective than our first-generation VIA chip. So it's a good match for certain of our engines and building blocks, particularly the regulator blocks. So they've sampled to key customers very advanced regulator, PRM-type regulator products. They've also sampled have an initial product line of ZVS BAC products, which are step-down regulators. They'll soon have boost regulators, an expanding product family of very compact and cost-effective and high-performance products that leverage our proprietary ZVS and ZCS engines. So they play a very key complementary role to the chip activities. As you might imagine, for certain of the building blocks of our factorized power system, a more complex packaging technology is needed given transformer functionalities and other functionalities that need to be integrated within the package. The divide and conquer strategy that we have with PICOR has to do with implementing certain functions, in particular the regulator functions, through a system in a package, packaging technology that is mainstream and more generally available. So the value proposition with PICOR is the very high silicon content within a common denominator SIP package, and that's to be differentiated from the chip and via chip portion of the challenge, which has to do with other engines that require a much higher level of power component integration with magnetic and other types of functionalities.
But this is still a negligible part of your business. What's going to take?
Well, it won't be negligible all that long because as we get into the middle of next year, with design wins have taken place, they are going to be shipping very substantial quantities of SIP regulators. So, you know, as we look at the second half of next year and entering the beginning of 2015, PICO will be in double digit in terms of millions of dollars per year.
Okay. So you expect that to gain traction by the second half of next year?
There's going to be a big step up starting in the middle of 2014 and further growth as we progress into the latter part 2014 and 2015.
Okay. Then I had a question on, well, a couple of questions. One, what are your prospects in the supercomputing business and also the auto industry?
So we are making progress in the supercomputing business with other customers, and we are seeing, generally speaking, increased adoption of our 48-volt infrastructure in supercomputing platforms made by customers other than our original customer in that space. And again, this has to do with the total cost of ownership perspective that is becoming more prevalent, not just with companies that make and operate their own data centers, but also with computing product makers and supercomputing product makers. So we are getting a significant penetration at least two other accounts in that space that represent tremendous opportunity for us in years to come.
On the auto industry?
On the auto industry, as I warned in the past, that's a long haul, as we all recognize, but we are actively pursuing opportunities that will result in significant revenues, but we all need to be very patient with respect to that. That's not a near-term opportunity. But to give you a little bit more flavor with respect to that, the density, efficiency, and cost attributes of chip modules is a match made in heaven for automotive applications. So we are refining a product offering in that space to advance the performance and cost attributes and make the chip inside solution for automotive power systems, particularly electric and hybrid vehicles, a very compelling solution. But this is a long-term play.
Okay, sounds like you're back on a growth curve, and thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from John Zillin. Please proceed.
Hey, Patrizio. You've talked a number of times about how your design wins are up. I'm wondering if you can give us some metrics. I mean, are they up 10%, 20%? Can you give us a rough estimate of what you're talking about there?
Not going to give you a number. I can tell you that if I look at major customers, the major customers that I've been personally visiting, let's say in California on the West Coast, in the Southern states, Texas, have been growing at, you know, an exponential rate. There is greater and greater interest in our technology because of its differentiated capabilities, you know, particularly regarding the benefits of factorized power and 48-volt infrastructure and current multiplication to the point of load. And that's gaining traction, not just in computing, but also in communications applications.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So an exponential interest, that's big. I mean, that's a lot. So, yeah.
Well, I think we are happy with the level of interest that we're getting. I don't think we could ask for more in terms of appeal of the products that we've been shipping, as well as products that we've shown to key customers that are on our product roadmap.
Okay. You mentioned a couple times about a big step up in the second half of next year. Again, what does a big step up mean? Can you put any kind of metrics to that?
I'm not going to try and quantify it because of the uncertainties I was referencing earlier. Let me put it this way. Given the visibility that we have, we anticipate that over the next couple of years, so we should break past the ceiling of revenues that have capped our historic performance. And I think as that happens, it should get very exciting. So we see the interest in the products, applications, and the opportunities to support the expectation. And again, we have now for the first time a sales and marketing infrastructure, as well as the operational infrastructure to support some exciting growth that, frankly, we haven't seen in a long time on average. I mean, we've gone up, we've gone down because of certain setbacks. We've had some recovery, but, frankly, going up and down a little or a lot more on a roller coaster ride is not the kind of excitement that we're looking for. We're looking to get to new levels and build on those. And we think that the $200 million-plus investment we made in chip technology and Pico SiP technology will pay off big time.
Great. Okay, so what I think I'm hearing is that you, sometime in the future, near future, starting in the second half, sometime after the second half of next year, you expect record revenues and then sustained growth on top of that?
I hesitate to give you a precise roadmap with respect to record revenue levels and the like. I think I repeat in different words what I just said, which is that our visibility with respect to products, customers, and applications supports levels of revenues that we've never achieved in the past and continue growth beyond that. And that's what we're very much focused on.
And that continued growth is more of a little bit more steady than we've seen in the past, more of a...
I think the steadiness will come about as a result of diversifying the customer base. So,
absolutely.
So we are, as I mentioned over and over again, not delighted with the fact that with our new products and our new technology platform in the early going, we've had, if you will, excess dependency on relatively few customers. But that is changing. There is more and more motivation in the marketplace for going factorized power, and that's a very positive development for us. Also, as I mentioned earlier in answer to a question regarding AC/DC products, with chip technology, we are enabling much more cost-effective solution to provide a level of unprecedented connectivity from the AC wall plug all the way to the point of load by way of 48-volt bus, through proprietary engines and proprietary power distribution architecture that I think addresses the demands of a power system marketplace that is starving for better solutions.
Great. You've mentioned 48 volts a number of times. What about you had some luck with 350 or 380 volts. Are you also seeing new applications in that arena?
Yeah, we're seeing applications in that arena. We're also seeing applications in AC power systems. And again, we are uniquely equipped to, I like the analogy of airlines, because in effect, enabling a power system is a little bit like taking people from destination A to destination B by way, in some instances, of an intermediate stop. And that may make sense for a variety of reasons, depending on unique power system requirements. We believe to be in line with unique capabilities in terms of connectivity from any source to any load by whatever point is appropriate given the unique requirements of that particular power system.
Well, congratulations. It sounds like it's pretty exciting there, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Don McKenna. Please proceed.
Following up on some of those questions, back at the end of 2011 or beginning of 2012, I'm not really sure when it was that you had a goal of tripling the size and of the company in 5 years. And I know this wasn't intended to be a straight line effort, but it seemed like we got off to a little bit of a slow start on that. But with what's going on now, do you see that as a possibility again?
It's more than a possibility. That's what we're focused on achieving. And to clarify for the audience, the fact that we had a setback with respect to the timing of that objective, as you might recall, as I'm sure you recall, there were two specific developments that handicapped us for a while. One was a setback with supercomputing applications, particularly the cancellation of the Blue Water project, which cost us tens of millions of dollars in revenues. Also, what has been going on in the defense market. Historically, Vicor has had a significant dependency on defense applications, and I'll tell you what's been happening in that general space. So this has been a perfect storm of sorts that hit us over the last year in particular. And as we've managed to do in the past, I go back to the time of the bursting of the telecom bubble, where we had 70% dependency on communications applications with DC-DC converter bricks, and we had to make an agonizing reappraisal of where we would go from there. We've been through a similar evolution of late, and that's why you've heard us talk about application environments that are not part of our historical makeup, supercomputing, data center applications, high-end servers, Intel sockets. Intel sockets are getting more and more cost-effective, as well as penetration of, test equipment, other computing applications, automotive, as low as that is going to be. So we're looking broadly at the universe of electronic systems, focusing on those markets that align with a unique, modular power component capability. And leveraging that capability with a near-term goal of 3x5 and longer-term goals that go beyond that.
Great. Thank you.
At this time, we have no further questions.
Well, thanks very much, and we'll be talking to you in 3 months.
See you next quarter.
Bye-bye.
This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect. Have a great day.